Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. How's it going? I was very heartbroken and upset the last time I spoke to you folks, and I'll get into a little more of the Buster story, though there is a time issue now with it's going to be a little stilted because of how we're doing the next few shows. But before I get into that, I wanted to say that I'm very excited about my guest today, in that it's Yardley Smith, who plays Lisa Simpson on The Simpsons. And it was a great interview, a great talk. And I didn't grow up watching The Simpsons. Of course, I love The Simpsons, but I'm not a complete Simpson nerd. But I was always curious to hear about the process and who's on it and her life. She wanted to talk. She is a fan of the show. And it was very connected and revealing and interesting to know and learn the life behind Lisa Simpson. But also on the show, we have sort of a big deal. It's we have a very special preview of an interview I did with a comedy legend. And I'll explain it in a minute. Let me get you up to speed on what's happening with my emotional life in relation to my cat, Buster. I have to explain in the next few episodes, because my amazing producer and business partner, Brendan McDonald, needs to take a vacation. And God knows he deserves it. It's his wife's birthday present, and they're going away. And I'm happy for them. But because of that, I don't want him to have to think about anything that has to do with me or the show or anything other than relaxation and enjoying the company of his lovely wife. So and coincidentally, they're going to be someplace where they can't, connect to anything. So good for them. But because of that, I'm going to be recording these intros kind of on top of each other in the next few days. I'll keep you up to speed, at least now and for the next episode, as best I can, although much time will have passed since you'll hear them. But for right now, we got some good numbers back with Buster. His kidney numbers are going down, but the vet still did not sound that optimistic. I was thrilled because after 3 days of antibiotics and fluids, there at least was some results. We did an ultrasound. There was no blocking, but there was something there that implied either an infection, probably not cancer, or maybe some sort of toxin. But the kidneys are still not functioning properly at all, apparently. Like, the numbers to me sounded like a tremendous progress, but the vet was sort of cautious in getting me excited. So where it's at right now is I'm going to leave him there for a couple more days just to have the constant fluids and take in the antibiotics to see if there's a continued decline in the numbers and a continued functionality of his kidneys. All they really found on the ultrasound was that the kidneys were enlarged and that he had some fluid. The internist did not think it was cancer, but it's weird with medicine, both for humans and animals, apparently. It's all speculative in a way, and you can only learn everything you can learn, but still not know certain things. I don't know what caused it, but whatever the case, there was progress, and I'm hopeful, and I really want to thank all of you for your support. And the well-wishing, it does mean a lot to me because this guy is a good guy. And he's an interesting little cat. He's a genius. All right, I'll say it. Buster Kitten's a fucking genius, and we need genius cats in the world. And I hope his progress continues, and I will keep you in the loop, though it will be a little stilted. That's what I'm telling you. I'm going to go over there after I talk to you here and visit him. I'm going to go visit my cat at the hospital and try to get him to eat some food. Okay? Okay. Now, here's the deal with this. I had a chance to interview a comedy legend. Seriously, a comedy legend. Someone, you know, that we always wanted to do the interview with him, and we thought it would be a great WTF interview. The one and only Krusty the Clown. He was here in the garage for a WTF interview, and it was so revealing that everyone knew something big had to happen with this interview. So this Sunday, February 17th at 8 p.m. Eastern on Fox, you can see my WTF interview with Krusty on The Simpsons. It's the basis for the whole episode. I'm serious. It's called The Clown Stays in the Picture, and you'll see we really broke it wide open. But for now, for right now, I'm gonna play an excerpt of that interview. Basically, they had to cut some stuff for time from the episode on Sunday, so we wanted to let you hear all of it. So this is me with Krusty the Clown here in the garage. So, Krusty, where'd you grow up exactly?
I grew up on the Lower East Side of Springfield.
Springfield.
It's a very Jewish community.
Massachusetts.
No. It's in the state that's next to Tennessee, but south of Oregon.
Got it. Yeah, right. A lot of Jews down there?
Lots of Jews.
Uh-huh. And how? Yeah. And what kind of business was your dad in? What was his racket?
Well, his racket was he was a rabbi.
No kidding.
Rabbi Hyman Krestovsky.
Oh, no kidding. Yes. Big congregation.
Very, very big congregation. Uh-huh. Congregation.
Uh-huh.
Very conservative.
Uh-huh. Brothers, very, sisters, grew up with a lot of big family?
No, just me.
That was it,
and my mother.
Uh-huh.
Rachel's her name.
Uh-huh.
And
that's it, and that's what
my
they
did. My father wanted me to go into the business, you know.
Sure, into
in
show
business.
Oh, into rabbi or into clowning?
Rabbiing.
Yeah.
But I didn't have the well, this is a Yiddish made-up word.
Yeah.
I didn't have the shmoboingi.
Oh, sure. Right.
Something
sure.
like that.
So they spoke Yiddish in the home then?
They did.
Oh, that's
some of it was nonsense Yiddish.
Like
later
gibberish?
On, I talked to people, they go, well, Yiddish, and they would say, where the hell did you come up with that word?
Right. So that was sort of a joke they had on you,
father's
I guess.
Joke on me.
How did he feel, the rabbi, when he decided to go into clowning?
Oh, he was dead set against it. Uh-huh. I had to do it on the sly.
Secret clowning.
Secret clowning. I would do, you know, a bris, or I would do a bar mitzvah.
You would jump out when your dad was doing a rabbi thing in the clown outfit. And yeah,
oh, God forbid I did that.
Oh, never.
Oh,
huh.
It broke his heart when he finally found out. I was at an event. It was a big rabbi convention, I guess.
Sure, yeah.
And I got hired, and my father was in the audience. And one of the rabbis got drunk and hit me in the face with a seltzer bottle.
Sure.
Well, with the water, not the bottle.
Yeah.
And my makeup washed off.
Yeah.
My father goes, "Oi, Gewalt!"
Sure.
"Herschel!" And
That was it. Yeah. Were you disowned? Did he rip his clothing like he's
mourning? Yes, he did. He rented his tuxedo, which was also rented.
He rented his rented tuxedo?
Oh, yeah. And then he took ashes.
Right.
That were on the table and he poured on his head.
As
if they were, I was dead. I was dead to him.
It's interesting that he had the ashes there prepared. It was an ashtray.
Well, they were smoking.
Oh, okay,
okay. It was an ashtray.
That's a terrible, terribly sad story.
It was very sad. We were estranged for a long time.
Uh-huh.
And then we were reunited.
Oh, yeah, right before he died? Or
before he died, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, not after.
Oh, good. Well, good.
I don't want to be reunited then. I still want to hang around.
Yeah, good. I just got to say, Krusty, I've been in this business for like 30 years, but I think about, you know, like everyone who's been an influence on me, and I got to tell you, you were one of the biggest.
Oh.
Yeah. I used to watch you perform, and then I wrote it all down, and I just wanted to make sure I didn't do a single thing that you did.
Yeah, well, that's smart. With me, it was the opposite. I stole from everybody.
Oh, one of those guys, huh? Who'd you steal from?
Oh, I stole from Jack Carter, Corbett Monica, Morty Gunty.
Wow.
Alan King, Phil Leeds.
Yeah?
You name it, I stole it.
All the big ones.
I stole from people who looked like they were going to be sick and die so they wouldn't sue.
Yeah, but you were probably stealing from people that stole from people that stole from people.
Probably stole from Bert Williams. I don't know.
What about Shecky Green?
Did I steal from Shecky?
Oh, come on.
I got an ashtray with his name on it.
How about in the 70s? Were you stealing in the 70s? Like Lenny Schultz, Billy Braver, Sammy Shore? Did you steal
Sammy
their stuff?
Sammy Shore, yeah, I stole from Sammy Shore.
Well, I don't know. You don't feel bad about it?
No, I mean, Sammy was very, very big about it. Very big after I paid him.
Who were some of the other people you work with, Krusty?
Well, you see here, I worked with
Godfrey Cambridge?
No, I stole from him.
Uh-huh.
I did a lot of, civil rights stuff, but it didn't go over very well.
How about, was it Lester and Willie?
Oh, yeah, well, I did steal Willie from Lester.
He stole the doll?
Yeah, it was a kidnapping. Dummy napping.
Did you try to do the act with Krusty and Lester?
I don't know if I stole Willie or Lester.
Well, one of them would probably resist.
Yes.
Yeah.
I guess it was a guy who didn't resist. Just laid there.
You talk about Red Fox?
Red Fox. Oh, boy, do I had stories about... He was so dirty.
Funny.
Very funny, but dirty. I used to open for him.
Yeah, but, what?
I couldn't say a single joke that he said on this...
It's a podcast. Really? You say whatever you want.
Oh, yeah, let me whisper it in your ear first. The other day, I was I said, what?
Jesus. Now that's in my head? I'll never get that out of my head. God, that is filthy. You know, you ruined donuts for me. I you ruined them.
You ruined them for me, too.
I love donuts, and now never again. Oh, my God, Krusty.
I know, I'm on Blintzes now.
Polluted my brain. Blintzes, how are they? They good?
Oh, they're great. Oh, Red Fox got another dirty story about that.
Oh,
want to hear?
Yeah.
And there's a... Oy vey.
Oh, my God. I didn't even eat that many Blintzes. Now I'm sorry for the ones I did eat.
Do you want me to ruin any other food for you?
Oh, with a Red Fox joke.
It's a great diet.
Amazing, right? How amazing was that? I sat with Krusty the Clown. And the rest of that interview is on The Simpsons this Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Fox. I'm not bullshitting you. Clearly, I mean, you heard it. Fucking unreal, the life I'm living. It really is. Very grateful. I'm not going to say blessed because it's a little weird. So as you're gleaning with your ears, this is sort of a Simpsons-themed interview. I talked to Yardley Smith, who is the voice of Lisa, and it was one of the great WTF conversations. It really was. And it's all sort of in connection with The Simpsons in its 30th season. This is its 30th season on Fox. And again, I am guest star on The Simpsons this Sunday, February 17th at 8 p.m. Eastern on Fox, interviewing Krusty the Clown right here in the garage. And Yardley was nice enough to come and talk to me. I love talking to her. She's also the co-host of the true crime podcast, Small Town Dicks. But you all know her and love her as Lisa on The Simpsons. So this is me talking to Yardley Smith.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
What do you got?
I have a present for you.
Oh.
I knew you had a lot of little things.
I have things. I keep building on my things.
So this is a collector's item that you can't get anywhere else.
Oh.
About season 3 of The Simpsons, they put out those little pins.
Yeah.
Those little stick pins.
Yeah.
And... I found them in a little like comic book store in the valley.
Yeah.
And I bought them all.
Yeah.
And
you didn't have a hookup at the...
Oh, God, no. Are you kidding?
No merchandise
hookup? Oh, no. I mean, so much stuff. People go like, hey, look at this. I'm like, where the hell did you get that? Like, don't they send you that? I'm like, no, they send us nothing.
Ah.
And so, and I was so in love with it. And then, but there were only about 15 of them.
It's a pretty great little flying Lisa.
It's a little Superman Lisa.
Yeah.
And so I actually... did an end run. I tried to get the show to make more.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't. And so I had more made.
You did on your own?
I did. Which I'm, of course, not supposed to do.
And
so now yeah. I still have about...
Oh, no. Now you're going to be in trouble.
Now I'm in big trouble.
So now... So you just got them because you liked them so much and you
yeah.
thought it was a shame that they weren't out there.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of Lisa merchandise out there. It's hard to come by.
But she's like the probably the most intellectually and emotionally important character.
She is.
I would think to the young women of the world.
Yes. You know, I hear that a lot.
You do?
Yeah. From people who say, you got me through a hard time or...
Right.
You know, you hear that as
I
well.
I do, yeah.
And it's... I never, ever, ever take it for granted. And I'm always surprised and I'm always enormously grateful, A, that they would share that with me.
Yeah.
And B, that anything I did could have any, that could have that profound an effect on someone.
You don't know when you're doing it.
And that's not why you do it. At least,
no.
I don't think you can reverse engineer it.
Incredibly
you know?
Selfish reasons.
100%. That's right, to fill that hole inside.
Yeah, and exactly.
And turns out you actually help somebody else fill their hole.
Yeah, and you're like, oh, thank God. Maybe even patch a hole here and
maybe.
There.
Maybe.
Those you are know, hard to patch, though.
There's a lot of triage.
Yes,
but, you know, patches are good.
Yes, I'd like to seal a couple.
Sure.
You know, permanent.
Boy, howdy. I'm with
but,
you.
The patching, you know, the problem with patching is if you don't do upkeep. They
no,
just come off, they rot away, and
yeah,
then the next
do.
Thing you know, you
lose the adhesive.
Yeah, and you're like, why am I here again?
It's still jagged.
Fucking patch came
yeah,
off.
Fucking yeah, fucking patch.
Yeah. But I would have to assume that now, like, I mean, what is this, the 30th anniversary of The Simpsons?
Yes.
So there are probably women who are like 40 who come up to you and go like, I grew up with you.
Yes. Oh, all the time.
and
a lot of there's a lot of tears, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I mop up a lot of tears. And they're shaking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
people
of course.
People shake
oh,
when
yeah.
they meet you.
It's a little wild.
It is wild.
Yeah.
But actually, to your point about yeah. growing up with The Simpsons, we actually have writers who grew up watching the show hoping that their dream job would be
yeah.
to write on The Simpsons. And I'm sure they all thought, but it won't still be on by the time I'm old enough. Like, yes, we will.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's going to be
That's
on
right.
forever.
And then all the writers who started with us, or many of them, are still with us because they go out into the real world. Mm-hmm. It's a totally different, much more sort of dog-eat-dog scenario out there where you get studio notes and
yeah.
network notes.
Right.
And James L. Brooks said when we went to Half Hour that we would get no studio or network notes. That was one of his
caveats.
Oh, yeah. And Fox kept it, I think, because... A, they thought the show would never go past the first 13 episodes.
Uh-huh.
And B, it's James L. Brooks. Like, you're not going to say no to that guy.
And also, at this point, they're going to fuck with that machine?
Well, and now they can't. No, because it's literally in writing.
In paper?
Yeah, yeah. So the writers, they go out into the world. They get, you know, deals at Disney or wherever else. And it's horrible. And they all come back. So we have a massive staff for a half-hour show.
But do they just let them come back? And so, sure, and they just throw them on the payroll. And it doesn't matter. They're, like, happy to have everyone back. And
yeah. Like, Mike Scully, he's been our showrunner. He was our showrunner way back in the day.
I'm not, like, a full-on Simpsons nerd. I have a little distance.
Well, and we just have to talk about that. You're going to be on the show.
I know.
And your episode airs on the 17th of February.
It's very exciting.
I'm very excited.
Because
I actually heard Matt Selman, who wrote that episode, who's a genius, sent me a fantastic little... super secret snippet of you interviewing Krusty the Clown.
Right. And all because Lisa heard the podcast.
That's right.
She's
a fan of yours.
Right.
You as you.
As me, Mark Maron.
Yeah,
I am phenomenal. Mark Maron on The Simpsons.
That's right.
Is it funny? Does it
it's
sound
so
like
good.
A, does it sound like a WTF?
Yeah, it's phenomenal. I died. And Dan Castellaneta, who plays Krusty, of course, is It was what was fun was you were both so up to the task.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dan is incredibly shy, but
yeah.
You get him to get behind that microphone or on stage
yeah.
or anything, and he really becomes. He becomes that person. And I get to stand next to him when we record.
Yeah.
We record all together like
sure.
an old radio play.
You do, all yeah. the time.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Except for Harry doesn't record with us anymore, and Hank doesn't, because they live in other places.
Do they pipe in from an ISDN hookup in their house kind of thing?
Harry has it in his house, I believe. Hank goes to a studio.
Okay.
But they don't pipe in while we're recording.
Oh.
They do their separate sessions.
Right. So somebody reads for them during the recording?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have a guy.
Yeah,
we have a guy for that.
But I got Dan to show it. Do you do much improvising? I mean,
yes.
Oh, you do?
And sadly, it doesn't make it in usually because we're only a 22-minute show.
Right.
But I have to say, so I stand between Dan and Nancy Cartwright, who does Bart,
right.
among others, Nelson Kearney. And it never gets old. And especially Dan, who
yeah.
often has pages of dialogue just with himself,
right.
but different characters.
Oh,
and he
right.
doesn't even pause.
It's so fascinating.
It's remarkable. And I could watch that all day.
I've done a very limited amount of voiceover for animation. And when I see these old dudes that come in and they're just doing two or three, I'm like, that's crazy.
It's crazy.
It's crazy. But you do a few.
I do.
What?
Well, I do Lisa. And then I do an old woman named Mrs. Glick.
Yeah.
Who they've killed off and brought back to life several times. I think just because I do it so badly, they're like, that's so fucking bad, Yardley. We got to have some more of that.
You're entertaining themselves
yes.
at your expense
yes.
because they can.
100%. Yeah.
So you've seen a lot of these writers over the years move on. Like I know Dana Gould.
Mm.
And
yeah.
He's sort of a genius-y guy.
Yes.
But I also know Conan, right?
People always ask me, you know, what was Conan
yeah.
like when he was on the show? And I remember him being so quiet. And
I think that
unassuming. I when Lorne Michaels picked him out to host his, I was like, that guy?
Yeah.
Are you fucking kidding me? It was the farthest. He's the last guy in the world I would have chosen. But I gather he was rather different in the writing room.
I don't know. I think that if left to his real nature, he would certainly be a quiet guy sitting there, because like anytime he talks, it's a lot of
yes.
You know, he has to really launch. You know what I mean?
It's not. Well said.
It doesn't come easily.
It's right.
Like, even if he's just responding yes or no, it's like yes.
Yes.
Like he has to come out of himself.
Sure.
To do that.
Sure.
But I bet you that's true. But it's funny because his wit, the way he thinks, is it almost seems like it was a Simpson character. Like he thinks like, you have to think a certain way.
Yes.
To write the comedy necessary for that show.
I think that's true.
To be that smart and that paced and that, you know,
yeah.
like I don't understand. I don't. It's a marvel.
Either. It is a marvel.
But was this what you were? I guess some people, maybe nobody really sets out to be a voice actor. Do they? I guess
Nancy
some do.
Did.
Nancy.
Yeah, Nancy Cartwright did. She studied at UCLA with a guy named Dawes Butler, who was a big voiceover guy.
Yeah.
We also have another woman on the show named Tress McNeil, who's absolutely brilliant. And she only ever did voiceover, and she does Mrs. Skinner, but she's also been on every other cartoon you've ever heard of,
yeah.
like Animaniacs and My Little Pony and Futurama
yeah.
and you name it. So, yeah, there are a few. I think it's much harder now because you have celebrities doing all these animated films.
Right.
Like, I'm not a big enough name to
yeah.
get a starring role in those animated films.
You can't get in one?
Oh, no.
You haven't gotten in any?
No.
That's ridiculous.
No. I mean, they really want, and I guess, you know, look, Live and Be Well, I think the only thing I truly take exception to is
yeah.
this notion that when you're doing that voiceover job, that you're somehow slumming it.
Right.
As though voiceover isn't as much being an actor as being in front of the camera.
That's crazy.
And I think that's inaccurate. I really do.
I sweat when I do voiceovers. Like you have to lean in a way that is a little weird, you know, because like you have to sort of almost amplify yourself very specifically.
Yes.
Because it is all over
and
the audio.
But there's no less heart and soul into
no,
your delivery
yeah.
than if you were being shot, you know, from the waist up.
I think it's more.
Because you don't have the advent of body language and stuff. Yeah.
But I also think the way that voice works for people, just by doing it like this, without any visual at all, it cuts right into people. The you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like people have a very personal relationship with voice. But I think that it must be odd to be on one of the most popular shows ever made, and maybe comforting to be able to have a life.
Yes, it is the best of both worlds, for sure.
You know,
I get recognized quite a lot.
By Simpson fanatics, I would imagine.
Yes.
Or people know you from some
TV.
Well,
and I used to have a pretty robust on-camera career, and I look exactly the same as
right.
I did back, you know, 35 right. years ago. So I get recognized for that, too. But to your point, you know, paparazzi's not waiting at the bottom of my driveway. I can go to Ralph's and, you know, although people do hug me in the produce section, there's usually just one. I don't gather a crowd, you know what I'm saying? So
the strange person that looks at you for 10 minutes, follows you around the store.
Yeah, that does happen.
Sure.
But it happened, you know, what's funny is it happens more if I go someplace where they don't expect to see you.
Yeah.
Because they can't place you.
Right, right.
And they often ask me, did I go to sure. school with you?
Yeah.
No. If it was college, no, because I didn't get in.
Yeah.
So I know that's not true.
And if
I've never been here, and if you went to school here, then the answer is no. I mean, there's certain
And you let
things.
Them go through the, because you feel
sometimes.
Weird. Because when you volunteer that information, I'm Lisa.
It depends.
Or I'm from the movie thing.
Sometimes what I learned was the hard way was that oftentimes it's a rhetorical question. So when they say, or if the comment is, you look like that girl from The Legend of Billie Jean. And if I would say, I know, isn't that funny? They actually already know that I am.
Right, right.
And now they're mad that you won't own up to it. So I then...
So you used to walk away from it? I mean, you would not own up to it and then just
But it wouldn't always end well.
But
you are that girl. And then you're fucking like, you're an idiot.
Now you're an asshole.
Now you're caught. Now you're an asshole. So if they say you look like that girl, then I say I am that girl, and that's always fun too, because then the jaw just drops to the ground.
Oh my God.
Very, I mean, it's lovely. People ask me, what is it like to be recognized, you know, when you go out in the world? And I always say, particularly if I go to a place that I've never been, people I've never met are thrilled to meet me.
Yeah.
They're so happy to see me. Who gets to say that?
Yeah, it's great.
Like total strangers are like, oh my God, it's fantastic that you're here.
Yeah, and when they stop shaking.
And sweating and crying, and we can...
It's nice. I agree with you. It's nice because with what you and I whatever our level of celebrity is, it's probably different, but it's not enough to be annoying.
No.
It's always very nice. And I know that usually the people that approach me know me very well.
Yes. Like, well, you especially.
Yeah. You know, like they know things about my life. They know like the whole story.
What's that like for you? Because I'm less known in that granular way.
Well, I do respect the fact that they do have a legitimate relationship with me. And I think it's genuine.
Yes.
It's just very one-sided. And they know that as well.
Right.
But I try to be as gracious as possible and not be a dick. I don't think I'm generally a dick. I mean, sometimes I'm misread because I'm just thinking about myself, which I guess is being a dick, but I'm not being a dick to somebody.
Sure.
If they get me in the middle of something, I'm like, and I'm rude, it's not because I'm like, get away from me. It's sort of like, sorry, I'm panicking.
Well,
right
you
now.
Are allowed to be a person and have a life. I mean,
right.
You know, I always feel like if somebody approaches me, like if people are waiting for me at baggage claim.
Right. With your name?
Yeah. No, with pictures to sign and stuff.
Oh, right.
You know, I feel like it's a little, it's that.
But those aren't regular people.
No, it freaks me out a little because first of all, how'd you know I was coming? I'm not this person on social media saying,
I know.
I'm flying from New York to Los Angeles.
Right.
I'll be there in 5 hours.
Yeah.
Kind of person. And I feel like, yes, okay, I can engage to a certain extent, but this isn't actually a public event where I'll engage all day long as it takes. I'm happy to do it.
Right, but...
You know, you have to draw boundaries at a certain point, and that can get, it can get kind of hinky. People.
But those guys in particular, it's always like 3 or 4doughy dudes of different sizes.
And they have stacks of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
they're there all day.
How did you know?
And what, have you signed Lisa pictures?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's the collector weird.
It's very different.
I don't know where they're selling it.
I don't either. But can I get a cut of that 10 cents? Because, dude.
I know, me
it's
too.
It's my signature, my picture.
But, like, I don't, like, I'm like, are you doing well with this?
I mean, I know.
How many people are paying top dollar for a Marc Maron picture?
That's what I'm saying. Same.
But have you ever seen it for sale? Like a signature?
Once in a while. I'm not much of an eBay troller, but I have seen and it literally is for, you know, $2 or something.
Right.
It doesn't.
Right.
I mean, you're not going to make a lot of dough on that, dude.
But how do they know?
I don't know. And sometimes they say, oh, somebody, you know, tagged you in a tweet. And then I'll go back through my feed and nobody's tagged me.
That's
and I don't
weird.
Know if they have, or somebody saw you get it, you know, at the gate. I'm like, who?
Yeah.
Was it somebody inside from the airline?
Right.
Was it an actual bystander? Is somebody being paid off? I just.
Or sometimes when you're doing something in their city, they know you're coming in somewhere.
Yes.
I don't know how they find out.
I don't know either.
But that, sometimes I understand that, or if it's a festival, or if it's Comic-Con,
well, sure.
Or whatever.
But that's to be expected, right?
Sure.
And then you're...
But not just, you know, visiting a friend
right.
in Sedona.
And you're just coming back from that Thursday to Sunday
yeah,
jag,
you're like, what
right?
Is, what are you, who are you? What's happening?
What's happening?
So, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Washington, D.C.
Really? Mm-hmm. Were your parents in politics?
My father was a journalist for the Washington Post. And
thank God for the Washington Post right now.
Yeah.
Boy, I mean, I...
Yeah.
There's a whole generation of journalists who thought they were going to be limited to tabloid writing.
Right.
Or clickbait. And now they're like, are you guys ready? Because there's real work to be done.
There's
and they're
some
in
shit.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
100%. Yeah.
So was your dad that kind of journalist? What kind of journalist?
He was City News. Actually, before that, he wrote for the UPI, which is United
Press
International. I don't know that it exists
Europe?
Anymore. Yes, actually in Russia and Poland in the Cold War.
I
was born in 64, and I think they got there when in 62. I have an older brother who was born in 63.
So you were born in Europe?
Yes. My brother was born in London, and I was born in Paris.
So your dad was going up to Russia.
Yeah, in Moscow, and I think he loved it.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, they would you had to run to the phone and call in your story.
Sure, and then you had to get an outside line,
yes.
And you're in Russia, and you know someone's
yes.
listening to
no,
it.
My parents talk about it. My father's dead, and my parents are divorced, but
yeah.
They used to talk about how they knew that in their apartments, both in Moscow and in Poland,
yeah.
in Warsaw, that it was bugged.
Yeah.
And so if they ever had anything important to talk about, and they weren't, I'm sure it wasn't, you know, super secret politics stuff, but
sure.
They just, if they wanted any measure of privacy,
right.
They would go into the bathroom and turn on the water.
And that would...
And that was, I guess, enough of interference that you couldn't necessarily make out the words. Meanwhile, they got married in Moscow, and they're both American, and... because they're both American,
yeah.
The Russian embassy said, we'll let you know when you can get married. And then literally like on a Tuesday, they said, you can get married Friday. So nobody could come over. First
right.
of all, you couldn't really just pop over
yeah.
to Russia.
Tough
like,
invite,
you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have the only one photo survived from the wedding. All the rest somehow disappeared from their luggage.
Really?
Yeah.
They were taken?
Yeah.
Oh my God! So he had a place in Moscow.
Yes, yes, they had an apartment, both in Warsaw and in Moscow. And then, when my mother, after I was born, so I was born in 64, and my mother says at that point she said, "I have two babies and two hands. I'm
yeah.
going back to the States."
Right.
My father traveled quite a bit, I think.
Yeah.
When he was working, and I think it was sort of lonely and cold. And my mother is extraordinarily bright, but she said she wasn't very good at the Polish language.
Uh-huh.
And so I think my father really was like, rats.
Yeah.
So we went back. Both my parents are from New York City.
Uh-huh.
And they, or my father from Brooklyn, rather. And my mother from Manhattan. And so we lived with my mother's parents for a year until my father found a job. And that was at the Washington Post.
Wow, that seems like a very exciting life. So your dad spoke Polish and Russian?
Yes, I suppose a bit, you know.
I can't even picture what Polish sounds like. I know a little like from Yiddish here and there, it's sort of part of it.
Yeah.
But I don't know. But so I guess it wasn't necessary to speak it at home, was it?
No.
That'd be kind of weird.
No, yeah.
So like you're in growing up in Manhattan and like, cause you, so I'm a little older than you. So it must have been kind of exciting. Was it like real Manhattan?
Yeah. My grandparents lived at 98th and Madison, 96th and Madison.
Uh-huh.
And I remember
back when people could have apartments in Manhattan.
And they had a 50-foot hall in their apartment. You know, they had an apartment that had an actual dining room.
An
actual living room. Yeah. Now those rooms weren't huge.
Right.
But it did have two large bedrooms and then a small bedroom, which I remember was my bedroom when we would go visit.
Were they just like middle class people or?
Yes. Well, my grandmother had some money.
Yeah.
She was from St. Louis. Her father had been a doctor. But
not crazy.
No, not crazy.
The only person that can live in New York now is Hank Azaria.
100%. Yes.
And I'm sure.
Yes. And my grandfather was curator of prints at the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Your grandfather was curator of prints?
Yes.
Like
acquiring prints and, you know, making
exhibits.
That's
a very...
No, they're all very exciting. Fancy and intellectual. And then there's me who didn't even get into college, so...
Yeah, but you were surrounded by that.
I was, yes.
What'd your mom do?
My mom was a paper conservator at the Freer Gallery of Art, which is part of the Smithsonian. So she would repair books and pictures for exhibit.
Huh.
And she went to Radcliffe... And
such a specific, odd job.
It is. And then my father studied history at Harvard.
Huh.
And after he left, when I was about 10, I think,
yeah,
they moved him from City News to be the editor of the obituaries.
At the Washington Post.
Yeah. And it was fascinating because my father, I think what he really loved was the long lead obits because he was a history major and he loved, you know, it was like writing a biography.
Yeah.
He was not so good with the day-to-day with poor, you know, Jane and John Doe, whose spouse had died. And
I think Joe and Jim.
Yeah. I used to hear him on the phone and you could just hear him seething.
Disappointed that he didn't have a meaty obit to write?
I think. And he
can't some famous people with a life die?
More often.
Yeah, yeah. Why is there a glut of normal people?
What's wrong?
Dying with no real life.
Yes.
So how old were you when they got split up?
20.
Oh, so.
Yeah.
Not as devastating as 7.
No, not as devastating, but messy.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
We didn't have to choose who to live with, did you?
No, I was gone already. I was living in New York myself. I was on Broadway, actually.
Well, let's go back, though. So, like, okay, so you're growing up with this fairly, you know, intellectual bunch, art and letters.
Yes.
But but you don't want to go to college, or you're like, were you like, fuck you guys?
I applied to Vassar, Northwestern, and Yale.
That was it?
Yeah. And people are saying, like, why didn't you have a fallback school? I'm like, why would I want to go to a fallback school?
Right.
Why would I want to do that?
Yeah.
That's not how I'm wired.
Right.
Right. And so I remember, though, from the age of about 7, wanting to be an actress and wanting to be really, really, really famous, like the most successful you could possibly be. And I started to plot this plan for world domination.
So you are Lisa.
And so, yes. Although she is much more
progressive than you.
Resilient. Mm-hmm. You know, like I was fretful. I'm still fretful. I'm a terrible worrier. I worry. Like, and I was listening to your interview with Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah.
I respect how ambitious she is and unapologetic for it. I'm as ambitious, but much more polite.
Mm.
And I think if I were probably less polite, I'd probably be more successful.
How much, what do you mean? How do you judge success?
Well, here's that's a good question. Because what I've learned really late in the game and much after a lot of grief and depression is that success is an ever-changing landscape. And my folly was, my true downfall for so many years was I had this very, very specific vision of what my success would look like.
Yeah.
And when it didn't look like that, that must have meant I wasn't successful.
That being the most famous person in the world?
I think it was a little more like, I'll have the pick of whatever jobs I want. I'll win all the awards.
Yeah.
You know, I'll be an EGOT by the time I'm 24. And that it would fill up all the holes inside. And I think what I really learned, because I was like, I must not be doing it right because it hasn't filled up the holes inside, made me feel like, well, that must mean you're not that successful. Because if you were, then that would have worked. But of course, you can't reverse engineer it. You can't fill up the inside from the outside.
Yeah, you know, I know this stuff, you know, and I know that because I wrestle with that too. I worry. I'm a worrier. I panic. Dread is more. You know, like the last few days, I've been very overwhelmed, and I don't quite know why. Not even overwhelmed. Like, you know, when all of a sudden you're like, "Fuck, I've lived a long life already." And I've been through a lot of stuff, and like you start looking at your hands,
sure.
And like my vessel's getting older.
There's a lot of amorphous worry, I find.
Yeah,
dread.
Me too. And like I really tried to figure out like how to stop that because, you know, being a person in recovery, you know, there's this sort of like do what's in front of you, you know, stay in the present, you know, because like that idea that most of what you're reacting to is your brain is inventing, either
sure.
intentionally or not.
It's future dwelling.
Yeah, and that's or past now.
Right.
You know, if you're a man. So yeah, there was a few months there where you're like, I didn't do anything wrong, did I? So it's also just like future, but it could be as simple as like, you know, talking to you.
Sure.
Like 2 hours ago, I'd be like, oh, God, that's right. What's she going to be like?
I was so nervous.
You were?
Nervous that I would literally be the least interesting person you've had on this iconic podcast.
How is that possible?
Fuck.
Everybody's pretty interesting. I've only had a few duds, and even they were okay. Because the truth is, like, whatever I think has no bearing on how people are going to react to it.
Right.
But wait, so let's talk about this hole. How did it manifest? I mean, like, what was the illness or the, you know, like, throughout your life?
Yeah. I think there was a feeling of never enoughness. I really suffered from, and still do to an extent, but less so, perfectionism.
Yeah.
And somebody told me recently that there's this saying, of course I wouldn't know it because I'm a perfectionist,
right.
That perfection is the enemy of good.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh.
Wow. I never heard that one.
Oh, right. So that, you know, perfection will prevent you from doing anything, signing off on something that's good enough, right? Sometimes good enough is enough.
Yeah, but if you're a perfectionist, your barometer for what perfect is shifting.
Yes.
So there's no real precedent there. It's just that you know it isn't it.
That's exactly right. And you would set the bar high, and then you would touch the bar, and then you go, was the bar set high enough? And then you'd set it yet higher.
So you're just built to beat the shit out of yourself.
Yes. It's been tough. I've taken a lot of body hits in my 54? 54.
Yeah. It's come back a little for me, that beating myself up. And there's, you know, there's always a couple of things I could beat myself up about, but I really don't need to be.
Right. You don't. And it's a colossal waste of energy.
Yeah.
And I've tried meditation. I've tried a lot of things and this sort of, you know, self-talk and stuff. And I can't say any of it's been hugely successful for me, but I continue to try.
Yeah, I do that. I feel that way too. But also the thing I know about myself is that I know I should do those things and I'll try them, but I don't stick with them.
And then they don't work. And then you're like, well, fuck that, right?
But how are they going to work?
Keep doing it.
Right. How are they going to work twice?
I don't know. Exactly.
It has to become a practice.
It's exactly. As much as you beat yourself up, you then have to do the counter. Otherwise, the beat yourself up will always win.
That's right. Because then you try things and it doesn't work. Then you beat yourself up about that.
Because you didn't do it right. Yes.
but that means only one thing to me, though, is that there's something about beating ourselves up and being in that zone that is more comfortable than the possibility of not having it.
Yes, I do think for me, I have used it as a motivating force, as though if...
But on purpose, though? See, like I've said that too, but is it on purpose?
I don't think so. I think it's so innate, but there's this deep-seated fear that if I... Although nothing in my history suggests that I've ever dropped the ball and let it roll under the couch, ever.
Right.
but maybe today will be that day. And then what? And then I'll just become like this sloppy couch potato and never do anything ever again.
That
really,
you really
hardly?
Think, really think
really?
That?
No. I don't. I just don't think. No.
But where's the control thing? Was there chaos? Was there alcoholism in the family?
Yes. My father was an alcoholic. Then he got sober when I was 10. And then he fell off the wagon a few years later. And then he got sober again and was sober till the end of his life.
So that'll do it. Well, you're lucky you didn't end up boozing.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what...
I was bulimic for 25 years. That's sort of this... That's a lot.
25?
Yeah. From the time I was 14 till... I remember when I was... I think I was 39 and thinking, I cannot turn 40 and still be doing this.
Oh, my God.
So I trotted myself off to an outpatient program at UCLA for 13 months at 39.
Okay, yeah, 39, yeah.
And you know, basically what it was group therapy. And one of the things we would do is we had to eat together as a group. And when you have an eating disorder, of course, it's a very private ritual. You are embarrassed about eating. You don't want people to watch you eat. I would never, if I had a meeting with somebody, say, I would never have it over lunch.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to eat with a stranger. You know, there's a lot of stuff.
But were there two modes of eating, like eating in public and eating alone?
Oh, yes.
Right.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
So you kind of learn how to like eat like a person who eats like a regular person.
Yes.
And then... You do whatever
and
it is.
And not to be afraid of food. Like, food really was the enemy, right? So you basically learn to kind of defuse those landmines.
What do you mean?
Well...
Oh, you mean in treatment?
Yes.
Because I grew up with an anorexic mother. She's still functioning. Like, I talk about it because it's her life is managing what she wouldn't call an eating disorder.
Right.
You know, like,
right.
But like it's between me and you and the few times I've talked about this on the show, it's my primary fucking sickness is my relationship with food. Like right now I just took off like 20 pounds and on purpose, you know, work, diet and everything else. But now like, you know, if I put on, now I'm on the scales again.
Right. It's horrible.
So if I'm thinner now than I've been almost ever. And it feels great. Like, I love to feel starvy. I like when, like, you know, like,
me
like
too. And I rarely am.
Yeah. And, like, I'm getting on the scale. And even though I lost 20 pounds, specifically to prepare for being on the set of Glow, because I didn't want to be pudgy because I know I'd eat. But then I just got hooked in the losing of the weight. And now if I put on a half pound, I'm like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
These pants.
Absolutely. It's a really vicious, vicious cycle.
I'm
and by the way, you know... of course, the scale is the worst metric of how your body is doing. But we're attached to it.
Well, so tell me about tell me about this process where, about the redefining your relationship with food.
Yeah. So one of the things we had to do was eat together as a group. And that was always really...
Because everyone had a different style of sickness?
Yeah. And yes. So some were anorexic, some were bulimic. Overeaters. I was a binger, but I only binged on sweet things. I only binged on cakes, cookies, ice cream, and things that...
The best.
Yeah. And actually, I did a one-woman show 10, 12 years ago.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And because I wasn't getting any work, right? I saw The Simpsons, but I wasn't getting any work outside of that.
Right.
But I hadn't been getting any work for a really long time.
But you're making a living. You had health care.
Absolutely. You know, it really was the fact that I had The Simpsons has provided me extraordinary opportunity for choice, right?
Yeah.
The ability to say yes or no to whatever I want. You cannot put a price on that.
Yeah.
And that really has been... the greatest gift of that show. Plus, I really love my character.
Yeah.
But I did this one-woman show, and at the time, I was newly recovering from my eating disorder.
Yeah.
And so I did this, I did a game show where I would teach you how to binge and purge, and pretty much every night, somebody would walk out at that point. And my friends who... I don't know if they're trying to make me feel better or what. They're like, but Yardley, that means you moved them. You touched them somehow. You made them uncomfortable. Or I'm like,
right. So you were making light of it because you had gone through it.
Yes.
So there was humor in it for you. But it probably triggered, you know, people who were active.
I guess. Or they just thought it was disgusting and this is way too personal and what the fuck's wrong with you.
But that's what a one-person show is supposed to be. You're supposed to, you know, purge yourself at the expense of audiences.
Yes.
And then you move through it and decide whether it was a good thing to do or not.
Right. Exactly.
There's no future for them, really.
No, there's none. 100% not.
But, you know, I know. I've done several, you know.
Yeah.
But there was one that I did that was, I was in the middle of divorce and separation that was happening, and I was doing a show about it while it was happening, and I really didn't mean anyone to see it. It was workshopping, which was just sort of like, I don't know who else to talk to about this. So
thanks for coming.
Yeah, room full of strangers. This is going to get sad and weird. There's no control. It's still happening. Let's do it. It was terrible. But how do you know, like, what is, because if you feel like you've come through it.
Yes.
And so, because, like, when you brought up binging, like, I got off all the sugar and everything, but, like, I like sugar. But fortunately, like, with ice cream and shit, I got a slight cholesterol problem, so I'm, like, I'm afraid to die.
Right.
But, like, the other night, I had, like, a relatively healthy cookie.
Yeah.
And because someone brought them over. Mandy Moore brought me fucking cookies.
Wow.
Four of them from Amara, which are those health. So like, I'm like, I can't do it. And I put them in the freezer. And then the other night I ate one and I'm like, oh, God damn it. And then I'm like, I got it. You know, it took everything I had.
Yeah.
It took my girlfriend going like, don't eat another one. I'm like, you don't know.
you don't understand.
How good it would feel. Right?
Right. Well, so, there were many things. So is it worth 5 minutes of satisfaction for 3 days of beating the shit out of yourself?
Well, that's a good question for anything. Or a lifetime of shame.
Yes. 100%, right?
Uh-huh.
And sometimes that works. But, you know, mostly I just learned to, I mean, I think we journaled, and so you had to write about, here's what I feel like when I can't binge and purge. You know, for me, I think I used to get sort of high, right?
Yeah.
It was
when
this,
you ate.
Yeah, it was this, there was a catharsis. You would get high and then you would sort of level out. You would flatline so that you didn't feel anything.
Right.
That was really the MO,
right? Yeah, yeah.
And now I just don't, like, I don't keep ice cream in the freezer because that was a huge trigger for me.
Right.
I really like ice cream, but there's other things I can have that I like just as well, and that's fine.
Like what?
I love cake.
Oh, you can have cake.
I'm a big fan of cake. Yeah.
See, my mother's style is she buys the ice cream, she'll wake up in the middle of the night and eat a bunch of it and then throw it away.
Right.
And so there's always a situation where it's sort of like a family member tells a story about, you know, we had a party at the house once and they came over the next day and there was a chocolate cake the night before and he was looking forward to having a piece. And when he walked into the house, my mother was jamming it down the garbage disposal so she wouldn't eat it.
Sure.
She fed the garbage disposal much better than she fed, I think, her family. And the garbage disposal got the best stuff.
Right.
But that's her way. You know, well, it's darker than that in a way.
Yeah.
But she's okay. She's healthy. But, you know, it just is what it is, that relationship with food.
Well, and food, you have to face food every day, usually multiple
times. That's
right.
One of my ex-wives used to say, like, you, because we met in recovery. Mm. And she was like, look, with food, you know, you have to eat.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like their abstinence is not an option.
Right.
So you've got to redefine your relationship with that thing.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But did you did you go to the OA and stuff or that kind of stuff?
I just went to that.
The treatment, that was it?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's good that you got over it.
But I do remember I used to have dreams about binging.
Yeah.
You know, when I was abstaining from it.
Yeah.
And of course it wasn't. I went to that program and then I was perfect. And 13 months later, I'm like, hooray, I'm cured. There would be two steps forward, one back. And then it got out of the program and there would still be two steps forward, one back. And,
right, right. You look good and you seem well.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's been a really, now it's been a solid, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, I think, since I no longer have the terror of food
right.
that I used to.
Right. So. The terror because you can't control yourself around it, basically?
Yes, because it sort of became this monster. Yeah. I felt like I didn't have any power over it, I guess.
Right.
I couldn't control
it. Right.
I couldn't control my reaction to it.
Right.
And if I was having a bad day, I would reward myself with something that would invariably lead to bad behavior.
And you're a controlly person.
Yeah.
So that, and the only way you could control it was after the fact in a very messy, not socially wonderful way.
Not socially wonderful at all. It was not a group activity.
Sad private activity.
Sad.
Because that's what people say, that eating disorders are primarily control things.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I know that anorexia is that, but I didn't, like, bulimia, I guess, is too, but it's sort of like an after the fact thing.
Yes.
Like, I can do this and still win.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no one can watch
me.
The winning is not a trick.
It's not. And, you know, I was actually at my heaviest when I was bulimic.
Right.
Because you can't consume 4,000 calories and then expect will be no consequences, even if you barf it all up. It's not going to work that way.
Well, I'm glad you're better.
Thank you.
And this is always fascinating to me about cartoons and animated characters, is that, you know, you have this life. It's an emotional life of personal struggle and whatever you are. And, you know, that, whether the script, you know, implies it or not, informs Lisa.
Yes.
You know, I've always been fascinated with that, because I knew a guy years ago who was an out of control drug addict monster, but he did voices for cartoons, and I'm like, this guy's going into the heads of kids, you know. like in my mind, it's like, even if it's scripted and it's cute and it's funny and it's a bear,
sure,
it's still that fucking monster. You know, and I don't know if that plays, but I would assume it was. And you're fortunate that Lisa has gone through her own evolution, you know, with her own morality and political causes and personal habits. But it's always been evolving in a good direction.
Yes.
But I have to assume that your tenor and your heart connected to how you talk is part of the appeal of the thing.
I think so. I always say I'm actually only 33 1/3% of the success of that character. The writers really lay a foundation that is just second to none.
Yeah.
And they actually always often say that Lisa is them. They work out all of their childhood angst through that character.
Yeah.
So I'm carrying a pretty heavy load, people. It's a lot of responsibility.
It's just like, you know, generations of aggravated Jewish men.
Through this little 8-year-old girl.
I don't mean to. They're not just Jews who write, and they're not just men. You have women, men, religions.
We have few women, actually. They are mostly men.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is interesting that they would connect so easily to Lisa Simpson. But I think, you know, my theory is, anyway, that they're all the smartest guy in the room since the time they were 7.
Right.
And so anytime you do something that sets you apart from your peer group, I think it creates...
Yeah, fuck that guy. He's a weirdo.
Exactly. And it can be really isolating.
Oh,
and you don't know where you fit in, and you feel like an outcast. And so that element of Lisa Simpson, I think, is what's most familiar to them.
It's a heavy load.
It is a heavy load, dude.
These poor, nerdy, smart guys.
Are relying on me. Yeah. Oh, God. You might want to make sure your life preserver still works.
You're a vessel.
I'm a vessel.
A vessel of the sort of, you know, cynical, broken-hearted closet cases.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's nice.
It's good.
But where did you train to be an actress?
No, I didn't train.
No.
No.
Did you study?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
You didn't go to college and you just got on Broadway? How does that happen?
It's a good story, actually. So I had this great plan. Then I started doing school plays. Junior high school.
Yeah.
But before that, actually, there was a woman in my neighborhood in Washington, D.C. who had a single car garage that in the summer she used to turn into a theater, and she would get all the kids in the neighborhood, and we didn't actually put on plays, but she would gather us all together and dress us up in all these costumes. I don't know where she got them. And we would lip sync to things like Fiddler on the Roof and Sound of Music.
Yeah.
And we would also do living portraits. And so, you know, a living portrait is you look like the portraits,
yeah,
right? So I was this painting by Mary Cassatt.
Okay.
A little girl in a straw hat. So I wore this gray frock and I had a straw hat. And then I would stand there and the curtain would come back. And I remember my knees were knocking before the curtain was pulled back.
Yeah.
And then as soon as the light hit me, my knees stopped knocking. Yeah. And
I thought,
this is clearly where I need to be.
Ah.
And then I started to form this plan, right? That I
would. You felt seen.
Yes.
Yeah.
I did. And I think I felt, there must have been a measure of control. There was, you know, one of the things I loved about, I started out doing theater was I always knew what was going to happen. So as a future dweller,
interesting.
That was really pleasing.
Yeah.
So even if the ending was sad and bad, I could prepare for it because I knew what was coming.
I think maybe one other person has talked about that in that way. That makes such sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I
for
felt
2 hours.
Really, exactly. I'm completely safe.
Yeah. Right.
And so I did these school plays and I was a huge hit. And while I was doing that, I also would look in the newspaper and go and audition for things around town.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I auditioned for when I was 14 years old was a play. I didn't know it was a plagiarized version of Peter Pan, but it turned out to be that.
A plagiarized version?
Yeah, yeah. At a dinner theater out in Arlington, Virginia, right across the Potomac.
Uh-huh.
And I played Tinkerbell, and I was bigger than all of the Lost Boys.
Yeah.
And I got paid $50 a week, I remember, which was more money I'd ever made in my life. And about the third week, my check started to bounce. And there was often more people on stage than in the audience, and it wasn't a very big cast.
Right.
And, but I remember thinking that it's okay. Soon the checks won't bounce,
were
and
you
I
on
don't
a
care
wire?
About that anyway. Yeah, I was on a wire, which, and I was wearing this really heavy, not at all invisible leather harness on this wire. And the wire was on a chain that you could pull a tractor trailer behind,
right.
And it would go like,
and you're just
like
dangling
stopping
there?
And starting.
So you're rocking?
I am. Singing my solo. And then the harness broke one night.
Oh,
and I
God.
Sort of like boink slipped out one side. And
scary.
Yeah. No, not really. I wasn't that far from the ground, but it was hilarious. But I remember, and then one night I showed up so what I didn't know was they were going under, which is why my paychecks were bouncing. And one night I showed up to do the show.
Yeah.
And actually at that point I had stayed on and I was doing The Three Musketeers, but I was playing a little old Italian man named Concini.
Yeah.
in gold lamé pants and a red tunic and a little black curly wig.
Yeah.
Horrible. And anyway, I showed up to work and the theater was closed and on the door there was a notice from the health department and a notice from the IRS. And nobody called to tell me that my mother didn't have to bring me to work that night.
That's so she had to explain it to you?
I cut on pretty quick.
You're like 14.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
And so I do remember thinking I still loved it. And if I still loved it after all that, I probably really loved it.
Yeah.
And so in the course of the next couple of years, I auditioned at a theater in Washington, D.C. called New Playwrights Theater. And it was an actual theater, it was a good, legit theater. I would audition for them once in a while. And of course, I would never get it because I was too young. But right after I graduated, they rang me up, actually, and they said, Yardley, how come you didn't come and audition for this musical comedy review? And I said, I don't know. I was graduating. I just didn't see it. So they said, please come. So I went and I got it. And it was sketch comedy.
Yeah.
And so I played Little Orphan Annie in a sketch about Annie. I played Cheetah in a sketch about Tarzan and Jane.
Sure.
And I got these reviews like your mother would write.
Yeah.
Your mother.
They loved you. You were hilarious.
I mean, unbelievable. And because of that, they literally went on for paragraphs, which hasn't ever happened since, by
the way.
These
are comedic roles.
Yes.
Obviously.
Yes. Yeah. I got an audition at Arena Stage. Now, Arena was the best, you know, theater in town that didn't have bus and truck shows, right? So it wasn't like the Kennedy Center.
Yeah.
They book in the Broadway shows.
Sure.
Or the National Theater does. But Arena had an actual resident company at the time, and but they cast everything out of New York, and so it was very unusual that they would dip into the local pool.
Yeah,
and they called me up, and I went and auditioned for a Tom Stoppard play, and I got the part, And although I do remember, they said to me, the casting director at the time said, you know, really, the reason we hired you is because you're so inexpensive.
Uh-huh.
Because
nice.
I wasn't a member of the union equity at that time.
How old were you then?
17.
Yeah.
And so this is actually great. This will tie back to your world. While I was at Arena, I did a reading of a play by Lewis Black.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Called Hitchin.
Uh-huh.
And he loved me in that reading, and we ended up doing that production at a theater in Ohio at this, it was called Kenyon Festival Theater at Kenyon College.
Yeah.
And everybody else in that show is from New York, and so all their agents came. I got an agent. I moved to New York 2 weeks after that show closed, and 6 weeks later I was auditioning for Mike Nichols to be in The Real Thing.
And did you get it?
I did, but what they didn't tell me when I auditioned was that I was actually auditioning to understudy Cynthia Nixon in the role of the daughter.
Uh-huh.
And I remember when I got it, they told me that it was for the understudy. I'm like, what? No. Oh, fuck no. I did not come all the way here to be an understudy. And my agent was like, who are you? You are going to sit down and shut up and pay attention.
And learn those lines.
Yeah. And so I was like, okay.
Did you ever have to step in?
I didn't have to step in because she was sick, but Mike Nichols, we opened on Broadway in 1984, January 84. And Jeremy Irons and Glenn Close were in that play, and Peter Gallagher and Christine Baranski and everybody. I mean, it was a big, big deal. And Cynthia. And so Mike Nichols pulled her out of The Real Thing after only 3 months in the run and put her in his production of Hurley Burley.
Oh, right. She played the teenage girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I got to take over the role, and that was a huge break for me. But what I didn't know was that understudies almost never take over a role.
Uh-huh.
You can make an entire career out of being an understudy if you're reliable and you know the lines. And I was, if I had known that, I would have just imploded.
Right.
Right. What?
Yeah.
Again, like, fuck that noise. Yeah. I am not doing that. So to be able to do it with the original cast, and then I actually stayed on and did it with the cast that changed over.
Wow. That was huge.
It was huge. And I also, in that time, those 2.5 years in New York, I did 3 movies, and I did an after-school special, and I was really successful in the beginning. And everything is going. I know, it's terrible. But things were going sort of the way I had planned. And I do remember when I turned 20 years old thinking, you better keep this trajectory up.
Yeah.
Because in a couple of years, everybody will expect you to have accomplished all that you have accomplished. So you better not slack off.
Everybody? You mean everybody in your head?
Yeah, I think so.
What were your parents doing? Were they like into their own worlds, or were they supportive? Or
my parents split up when I was on Broadway. My mother was, she came to everything.
Yeah.
She was really supportive. My father, he wasn't around much when we were growing up.
Yeah.
And so it really wasn't until actually that review in the Washington Post and the Washington Times.
When
people started coming up to him going, oh, you're Yardley Smith's father.
Yeah.
That he really sort of went, oh.
Oh, yeah.
Are you doing a thing here?
Right, right, right.
Oh.
Yeah. And people are complimenting me.
Yes.
So I should know
you.
What. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So everything's going great in New York, and then you come out to L.A., and are you kicked in the pants, or what?
It was funny when I came to L.A. I had all this success in New York, and there was definitely the attitude of, so fucking what? Now you got to prove yourself in a different way here.
Oh,
right?
That. Right. It wasn't like, I'm going to go out there and everyone's going to love me.
No, I thought that, of course.
Yeah.
And then they said, you got a thing or two to learn.
Right.
And so, but I was game. I was like, fuck you. All right. I got you. And I looked so, so young when I was, if I moved out here in 85-ish, so I was like 21.
Yeah.
I looked like I was 12. And so I could play everybody's daughter, niece, sister, you name it. And I worked like gangbusters. I came out, I got a pilot the pilot didn't go, but then I did a bunch of guest spots. I did, I continued to do movies. And in 86, I think, is when we started to do The Simpsons on the Tracy Ullman show.
Yeah, Tracy Ullman, yeah.
And I remember thinking, what the fuck is this job? I don't give a shit. Like, voiceover wasn't part of my plan for world domination. So I really had no interest. I'd put no eggs in that basket, none.
It probably didn't even seem like a living at that point, in a way.
It didn't. And at that time, it wasn't, you know, it was pre-scale. It was, you know, whatever it was.
It was pre-cartoon world domination.
100%.
Yeah. So you just did the Tracy Ullman bits, the sketches.
Yeah.
And you met with Matt and
I did. He would write.
James.
He wrote all those scripts.
And Sam.
And we didn't see a lot of James L. Brooks.
What about Sam?
Sam would come up. But Sam really became much more a presence when we went to Half Hour.
Uh-huh.
And
I interviewed him before he passed.
Yeah.
It was wild.
He was such a... I was happy that he became... He found his calling with the animals.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
You know, he was... He didn't... At least when I knew him, he didn't seem to enjoy his success as much as he should, considering how much success he was having.
Yeah. Well, I mean, seems to be all of our problems.
It does. What are we going to do about that, Mark?
I got to find my animals.
Yes. So you have cats.
I know. I got three cats.
I have two cats.
That's the extent of my philanthropy with the animals. I also donate money to a tiger rescue operation in North Carolina.
Oh, fabulous.
It's kind of wild. It's in North
Carolina.
They're
rescuing actual tigers?
Yeah, like domestic wildcats.
Right.
Because people can buy tigers and they think they're cute, and then all of a sudden they're living with a monster.
They're 300 pounds or more. Yeah,
so they
1,000 pounds.
They get them from like zoos, like crappy zoos or roadside attractions or people that
accumulate.
But yeah, you go out there and you can go see them and everything, and they just kind of take care of these cats.
I love that.
And I don't know, I've been there a few times.
How did you find them?
Yeah, North Carolina Tiger Rescue. So, well, I was doing a show out there and someone said, you know, you're a cat guy, you should go... Go out there and look at the Carolina Tiger Rescue. What are you talking about? You go out there, there's a fucking, you know, lions and tigers.
Do you get to roam with them?
No. but they have nice environments and they're fed well and the people there are good-hearted. And it's a very specific niche.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? People call them up and go like, there were two tiger cubs in this shed.
Can you
come get them?
God.
It's crazy.
That's brutal. That's horrible.
All right, so Omen happens, but you did, you were a regular on a few sitcoms, right?
Well, Herman's Head, I was a regular. And then I remember that show was one of the first sitcoms on Fox, right, along with Married with Children and Simpsons.
Right.
And I remember I was doing both at the same time, The Simpsons and Herman's Head. I was never happier because I was completely slammed, you know, schedule-wise.
Right.
And I remember, and I was a... what they would call a breakout character on that show. I was
on Herman's Head.
Yeah. Played Louise Fitzer. And Hank was on that show too.
Yeah.
And so when that show got canceled after three seasons, I remember thinking, well, this is phenomenal. I have some real momentum. I'll be able to, of course, just migrate to another show. And that didn't happen. And that was really around the time when things started to slow down considerably.
Yeah.
I did, after that, get a recurring role on Dharma and Greg, where I played Greg's crabby secretary, Marlene. Yeah. But, you know, the business was changing, and I didn't know how to adapt. I don't know that there is anything I could have done. So I would say it was sort of the perfect storm, where you had now movie stars were wanting to do television, because television sort of recognized, if we do limited series like they do in Britain, for instance, just 10 episodes, like you do with Glow, right?
Right.
12 episodes, then we can get these massive names, because they'll commit to 4 months, but they won't commit to 9 months, which is a regular 22 episode season.
Right, and also the quality, because directors are coming too. I think The Sopranos changed a lot.
I agree.
You know, like all of a sudden, like, oh wow, this is TV. It's
like,
it's amazing,
and it really changed the landscape of it. And so, I wasn't enough of I was like a really solid working actor.
Right.
Right, who you could always count on. But I wasn't a name. And so if you're going to get a movie star to be the star, now the person who used to star on television is going to be the best friend. And the person who used to play the best friend, who was me, is now going to play the friend of the friend, if there is a friend of a friend.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And then,
there was a trickle down.
Then all of a sudden you're a clerk.
And now, exactly. And I mean, literally.
Right.
Where you're reading for a page.
Right.
And I always say it really isn't about the size of the part, but if the part is, if it's not the best one page in the script, or if there isn't something that is really special about it, if anybody who's actually fluent in the English language could read these lines, then
and do it. Yeah.
Yeah, then fuck it. Like, how long do you have to be in the business before you acquire enough equity in order to A, not have to read for one page, and B, actually get to do something that you feel like, yes, I've paid my dues, I work my ass off, I love my job, let's do this.
Right.
Right.
Well, oddly, A-list people, they got to read too.
Yes.
I mean, it's like, it's not easy, like, it's weird. There's such an abundance.
Yes.
At this point.
And like I said, I don't mind reading, but let's make
respect
it,
me a little
right?
bit,
right? Yeah. Like, make it something worthwhile,
right?
You just want it to be so. Work really, really started to dry up, and I couldn't. The problem was I stopped even getting auditions, and so if I can't get the opportunity. And I didn't know, because I'd never had to, I didn't know how to make opportunities for myself.
Right.
And I didn't want to. You know, at that time, it was really starting to become clear that you had to be this multi-hyphenate. You had to be actor, writer, director, actor, producer, writer. You had to, couldn't just be an actor anymore.
Right.
And I didn't want to do those other things. And so I kind of dug my heels in, and it was not smart. And a solid 6-7 years passed where I was like, what the fuck is happening? I didn't know. And that's when I did my one-woman show, right?
That's usually the arc.
Exactly.
Of that.
Where you're like,
I'm gonna
all right, I will. I'll do it. And then I thought, it was directed by Judith Ivey, who's an amazing actress
and was a phenomenal
director. And I thought, this will get me more work. And of course it didn't. I did get a great review in the New York Times for it, but that it was too late. And so after that, I ended up, a couple years later, I fired my agent who I'd had for 22 years, and then I couldn't get an agent.
But the weird thing is like you tell this story, but as all this is going on, you're on The Simpsons.
Yes, thank God.
But the weird thing is because I feel it too, is like when I get an animated, when they want me to come do one, like as a guy, I'm not a real actor though, in the sense I didn't spend my life trying to do that, but you still sort of think like, oh, this is a nice perk.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe I'll go do a voice on a thing, right? So I think that as an actor, there's some part of your brain that always thinks about it like that. Like, you know, yeah, I do the animated thing, but what about the real thing?
Well, again, if you don't, If voiceover isn't even part of your plan, right, for world domination and what you will consider successful, when you get the voiceover, of course, it doesn't count.
Right.
It doesn't carry the weight that it actually could and should.
Well, when did it start to do that?
Yesterday?
No. Wait, on your way over?
Yeah, on my way over.
Because like I said earlier, by all, you know, you do have world domination. And you guys, like, through whatever, you know, victories you had with contract disputes, you clearly are set for, you know, a few lifetimes.
Yes.
And, you know, what's sad to me about that, and even at the small level that I have made some money as of late in the last decade, is that you never want to believe that money's not going to make it all go be better.
It's, right.
You don't want to believe that. When you don't have money, you're like, you're out of your fucking mind.
Sure.
If I had money, it is a big thing off the table, like to not have
to
worry about that.
It gives you freedom of choice.
Right. But then you realize that, like, you know, great at freedom of choice, but how come my choices are still limited to these 9 dumb things that I'm always circling and I've never how is the inner
Well, it doesn't fill up the hole.
I know,
right?
But
it doesn't. I don't think it takes the questioning away.
But what is that? Is it really questioning, or is it just sort of this dumb commitment to discomfort? I mean, what the fuck? Life is short. We're both around the same age. Like, I'm forgetting more things than than I'm learning.
Yeah.
And like a lot of things that were so important at another time in my life, just don't. They're not anymore. So, like, why is it that I can't just, like, you know, sit with myself without feeling guilty about it or wondering, you know, like, is this it?
Right.
Like, should I be doing something else? And, like, is this living?
And I think that's what I mean when I say oftentimes I don't feel successful.
Yeah. No, I know. I get it. You know, but
that it's something much more internal than the forward facing Yardley, who is embodies this iconic character on this extraordinary show.
Right. But
that was the only barometer. Yes. Hooray. We ticked the box.
I guess what I'm all of a sudden having issue with is the idea that it's we're having a revelation here that it's actually a hole. I don't know if it's a hole. I think it's a sad existential realization that, you know, life is just what it is. It's fleeting. And there is, as a control freak, you know, like, there is an end. You don't know when it's going to happen. And, you know, is it supposed to feel like this? There's nothing written anywhere that it's not disappointing.
Right.
Yet, yeah, for some reason, people in their, you know, in this sort of, as we evolve in this culture of narcissism, believe that this entitlement should at least yield us an amazing feeling.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And, but the truth is that, like, if you look at the history of human beings writing things down and doing things, the struggle for meaning and for it not to be sort of a letdown is eternal.
Yes.
But yet, for some reason, we're gonna say we have these holes. I don't know if it's a hole. I think it's just the nature of being a person.
It feels like a hole to me.
I guess, but other people, but we're just those kind of people.
Yes.
You know, we're emotionally hobbled for some reason, and we can't find satisfaction.
Right.
In the things that other people find satisfaction.
Isn't that it feels like a massive failing, doesn't it?
No.
It doesn't?
No, like I'm...
See, that makes me feel like, well, Yardley, you're fucking obviously not doing it right.
You're just not looking at it right, maybe. Like, I'm 55, and I have no children, and I've been married twice,
yeah.
And now I'm talking to guys my age that have kids who are in their 20s now, and they're like, dude, you dodged a bullet. And I'm like, you know, like, I'm like, you know, like, I did something right in my life. You know, like now that whole part of the idea of what you're supposed to have done, I'm sort of like, I made it through the tunnel. You know, I made it through, and I'm on the other side of it, and I don't feel any regret about that.
Right, nor do I.
So that's it's a victory.
Yes.
We're all alone with our head.
That's right.
So now we just got to...
There's just a lot of noise in the head, that's all. What can you do? I don't know.
Accept it. Right?
I do.
I know.
I do.
But I mean, do you...
I got out of the house, didn't I?
Yeah. Yeah, and you're not secretly throwing up in a bathroom.
That's right.
Everything's working out.
It's all good.
And you can buy things.
Yes.
So, but do you find over the course of doing Lisa that, you know, in dealing with these great writers and sort of watching that character grow, have you learned from that, you know, anything about life, you know, in the sense that, like, in your relatability to that character?
Yes.
I mean, were there life lessons that you processed from that other than that had to do with the job?
Yes. I am inspired by Lisa Simpson's resilience. I'm inspired by her optimism.
Yeah.
And I do think that playing that character has softened some of my sharper edges.
Yeah.
You know, and the responsibility of being on a show that is that iconic and embodying a character that seems to mean a great deal to an enormous number of people.
Yeah.
I feel like there in that is a tremendous privilege, and with that comes the responsibility to carry that with graciousness and to your point, to receive people who need to express to you what you've meant to them.
Yeah.
I never take that lightly, and it's sort of to whom much is given, much is expected, and I respect that and I accept that.
Well, that's good. That's a good thing in
yes,
life.
Yes.
Well, it was great talking to you.
Oh, thanks. Can I plug my podcast?
Of course. Oh yeah, how's that going? How many have you done?
We have 49 episodes.
Oh my
so
God!
Far.
So it's been going a long time.
It's actually only been 16 months.
Oh, so you banked a bunch and you're just kind of dropping.
Well,
them?
We do about 12 or 14 per season.
Uh huh.
And we're about to launch season 4 on March the 15th.
What's it called again?
It's called Small Town Dicks. It's a true crime podcast.
Oh, okay.
And I co-host it with my best friend and co-creator Zibby Allen and two identical twin detectives, Dan and Dave.
They're real detectives?
Yeah. And all of our cases are told by the detectives who investigated them.
And is it a scripted thing from?
No.
Oh.
It's amazing. And so Zibby and I actually do very little talking. We're the audience. We get to ask all the questions that you would if you had
great.
The opportunity.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's, and our premise was big time crime is happening in small town USA all over.
Right.
And with the same level of depravity and disregard for human life as in big cities, but just with less frequency.
Right.
But to
and people
hear
that might
these,
know each other.
And there's a real claustrophobia in that aspect of it, right? You drive down the street and you go, oh, I went to school with that guy. I also arrested him and he's, you know, blah, blah, blah.
I just had that this morning. I read an article in Albuquerque. They've been there 10 years ago. They found like 11 bodies buried on the West Mesa. And I'm like, I probably went to high school with that guy.
Oh, my God.
I don't know who it is. But that was my first thought. It's like, I wonder if I knew the guy that killed him.
Right.
Because it's a cold case, I guess.
Yes, it is. Right. So I'm really, really, really proud of it. And
that's great.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
So look, you're doing like your own thing.
I always do my own thing.
But this is like what I mean by your own thing is like once you get through and you kind of move through the one person show thing, that I know that feeling of like I have to make something happen. And as performers and as me as a comic who was not doing great at comedy in the, at the time I did some of the one man shows, like you're like, this is really going to be my own thing, but the form itself, you know, it has become a redundancy. So it's problematic, but you don't realize it when you're in it. And you're not even sure what you want out of it, you know, other than the recognition and to process this stuff.
And to really fuel that creative fire,
right?
You know?
And then you do that and it sort of frees you up to know that you can do that, but it's nice to land on something that, you know, you like have to refill and it's yours and you know, you have control over it.
Yeah, it's great. But hopefully some of your listeners will enjoy, if they're true crime fans.
It seems to be very popular now.
It really is.
It always is kind of popular, actually.
It is. I feel like, for me, what I like about, what interests me about true crime is that it's about trust.
Yeah.
You know, society can't function if we don't all adhere to a certain set of rules and values that we actually value.
Yeah.
And so who are these people who are willing to throw all that out the window
and
derail the train? Well, there's that guy. Fucking hell, dude. And so I like to know that there's also a force bigger than me that can put the train back on the track. And me, that's these detectives.
Well, that, and that's that as a metaphor is you know, the nature of hope in a democracy.
Yeah, it is, isn't
it? Yeah. All right, great talking to you.
Likewise.
What a great conversation. I love her. And she gave me that little Lisa pin, which I'll cherish. So, folks, don't forget, I'm the guest star on The Simpsons this Sunday, February 17th at 8 p.m. Eastern on Fox. The episode is called The Clown Stays in the Picture, and you'll see my full WTF interview with Krusty the Clown on that show, in the animated version, of course, of this garage. So I got to play something special on the guitar, don't I? I do. Boomer lives.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.